This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is Pop Culture Confidential, and I'm Christina Yerling-Biru. Hey everyone, welcome to Pop Culture Confidential, and welcome guest favorite friend of the show, journalist, film critic for The Times and The Guardian, and now host of the excellent new podcast Writers on Film, John Bleasdale.
Hi, Christina. Thanks for inviting me back.
Thank you for being back. Now, I'm calling this part one of a Venice show. We're going to be talking about the Venice Film Festival, which is right around the corner, the big titles and our expectations. Will there be a Almodóvar Sorrentino Oscar international picture race leading out of this and things like that? And then part two will be when we actually see each other there, because we're privileged to be going and see if we actually like these movies we're talking about.
Yeah, it's always a weird thing. I remember getting excited for a Cannes one year, which had a wonderful lineup, and then almost every single film kind of disappointed, even though, you know, you were looking at the roster and thinking, this is amazing. And then they were all kind of okay. There was no, you know, and then what happens is the thing that you're not looking forward to is the film that blows you away.
Sometimes when I see critics writing out of festivals also is that they're so excited to be there that everything is like 5+, 5+, 5+. And then when it finally comes out, it's like, you liked being in the room, I think.
Yeah. My big one for that was, there were a couple. Tony Erdmann was one where I missed the screening that everybody was in. And everybody said, it's the funniest film you've ever seen. And I watched it the day after and I thought, it's okay. It's not, I didn't think it was, but everybody who was in that room for that first screening, you know, gave it 5 stars. And yeah, so the atmosphere, there is a dizziness that can happen. And also because sometimes it's timing. Sometimes, you know, after 4 or 5 days, people are getting like, oh, we really need a big film. So when a film comes along that, you know, ticks a few boxes and excites people a little bit, there is a tendency to run away with it.
So fall festival season is upon us, and that includes Toronto, Telluride, New York, Venice, for example. And this year, we're still in the throes of a global pandemic. It's been a period for the film industry, which I'm sure will go on, which is the film industry is pretty massacred, to say the least. Before we start talking about the films itself, how is the Venice Film Festival handling this? And Alberto Barbera, how are they approaching a in-person film festival this year?
Well, of course, last year they did an in-person film festival at a point when the pandemic was still very much still a huge issue. And it was the first major film festival, I think, to do that. There were much fewer people, it has to be said. Maybe a half, if not a third, of the usual contingent, and there was a lot less talent as well, a lot less actors and stars, especially from America, which is zero. And I have to say, the organization was amazing. The organization was splendid. You could book your tickets. There was no queuing. There was no. There were checks everywhere. They were very strict on masks. They were very good. Hand sanitizer was everywhere. It really, really felt, in fact, it was one of my favorite festivals because it was so well organized that the collateral effect of that was, so for instance, not queuing, not having to worry about, will I get into the screening or not? You book your ticket, you're in. You don't need to worry. You don't need to turn up early. You just go walk in. And in comparison, Cannes this year, which of course was also in person and also had a lot of these measures in place, I felt was very, very patchy. You know, there was no social distancing, for instance. Venice is still keeping social distancing, even though Locarno and Cannes didn't. I mean, in Cannes, we had the ridiculous situation of having to sort of group en masse in order to check our green passes and our vaccination things before going in. So even though... And there was no, and the other you know, big criticism I would have put on Cannes is they have these huge theaters. For anybody who doesn't know, Lumiere and the Debussy, a massive, you know, 2,000-3,000 plus theaters. And they have a balcony, and they have an orchestra, two levels. And because there weren't as many people, again, you know, not as many people turned up this year as they would normally do, for many screenings, they would close the balcony and just put everybody in the orchestra. So even though they had the capacity,
they had the opportunity.
They had absolutely the opportunity, absolutely the capacity to do more social distancing. For every single screening I went to in Cannes, I was sitting with one person on either side. Yeah, there was zero social distancing. And I think they dodged a bullet there. I don't think, I don't think there were any super spreading events coming out of that. But at the same time, I don't think it was because of any mitigation measures that they took.
Well, that would be interesting to see if you feel the same way about Venice this year.
Yeah, I hope I'm not jinxing it by praising them so much last year, but they certainly have got a good record. And people beforehand were very, I think there's a slightly racist skepticism when it comes to Italy sometimes, that people, the Italians can't organize anything. Well, actually they can. They're very good at this sort of things when they put their minds to it. And so hopefully it'll be the same this year.
Well, it's an absolutely amazing jury that they've lined up this year with Bong Joon-ho, which of course, Parasite, Chloe Zhao, the recent Academy Award winner for Nomadland, one of my absolute favorite documentaries of last year, Collective, the director Alexander Nanu, and who else am I forgetting here? Saverio Costanzo, Italian director, Cynthia Erivo. It's a pretty massive jury.
Yeah, I love the way they've got Bong in, because he was, he kind of was breaking Venice's run of having these Oscar winners. You know, we get Nomadland again this year, so it goes back to Venice. But, you know, previous to that, we'd had Roma, we'd had Shape of Water, going all the way back to Spotlight and Gravity. It's just an amazing run of Venice's ability to program Oscar winners. And when Parasite came along, it was like, okay, Cannes has got one, but they've given the director the head of jury, so we still managed to net him somehow. No, that's a brilliant choice, and he's a wonderful cinephile. He's somebody who knows his stuff, as you would imagine. So and yes, Chloe Zhao has come to prominence, and you know, I had the opportunity of interviewing Chloe Zhao. Have you interviewed her, Christina?
I haven't.
All right. I'd
love to.
I interviewed her in China. I was in China for this very interesting festival in Pingyao, which is a small town in the middle of central China. And I interviewed her. She had the rider there. And she's just such a lovely, sharp as a whip, you know, absolutely... a brilliant mind and really approachable and interesting and loved talking and loved having a conversation and back and forth. And it was just a great interview. And so seeing all these wonderful things happen to her, you know, she's now directing The Eternals as well. Which
yeah,
is
her big Marvel movie. Can't wait to see that.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, it couldn't have happened to a nicer person.
Do you think there's an Oscar Best Picture winner among the lineup that they have this year?
Oh, that's a good question. I haven't really thought of it in that way. Jane
since
Campion.
You were saying that everyone, you know.
No, absolutely. You know, you're right. Maybe I should have thought about it. More. I should have thought about it that way. Really. I don't know. I mean, Jane Campion is a former Oscar winner who's coming back with The Power of the Dog. So there is a possibility there. The foreign language Oscar, yes, you've got several likely contenders in the mix. That's an interesting question. Maybe I might come back to you on that one. Yeah. I'm certainly in part two.
But let's continue on that. Let's get into some of the movies. I thought we'd start with sort of these bigger ones first, and then there's a whole bunch of the non-competition ones we can talk about.
Right.
But you mentioned Jane Campion. From my perspective, this is one of the movies I'm most looking forward to. I mean, Campion is one of my big idols, and I don't think she's done a movie since 2009, I believe. Then she did Top of the Lake for TV, but she hasn't done a movie in a long time.
Oh, didn't she do Bright Star? Was
That was many years ago.
Oh
I
yeah,
think
no,
she, yeah.
absolutely. No, it
Yeah,
hasn't
yeah.
been for a long time.
I think it's been decades since she's actually released a movie. And for reasons that she's been quite vocal about, that the industry is just a bitch, especially for women. But this one is based on a novel, and it's starring Benedict Cumberbatch, who plays sort of a domineering rancher whose brother brings home his new wife. They're played by one of my favorite real life couples, Kirsten Dunst and Jesse Plemons. And it's just an emotional ride. It's a Western. She filmed it in New Zealand. I just have great expectations for this movie.
I think I've loved Jane Campion's work since well, Angel at My Table and The Piano. So and she it is really, really frustrating. I talked to Helen O'Hara, who wrote this great book, Women Versus Hollywood, and one of the points that comes through that book is that the sexist structures of the industry, obviously the primary victim are the women who have their careers limited. But the secondary victim are the audiences who are denied wonderful work by women who, for no other reason than sexism, institutional sexism. And Jane Campion is one of these. Jane Campion is a director who should have made as many films as Martin Scorsese. You know, she's got it. She's absolutely, you know, it's no one could make the argument that she hasn't made these films because she doesn't have the talent or the knack or the capacity, you know. So yeah, it will be really exciting to see this movie. I mean, Benedict Cumberbatch in sort of American roles is sometimes, for me, is a little bit of a put off. I don't think his accent game is necessarily as good as it could be. I think he's definitely a talented actor. And you're right, Jesse Plemons and Kirsten Dunst are both, you know, bring a lot of quality to the party. And I get the feeling, I'm not sure, but I get the feeling isn't it kind of quite a sort of Southern Gothic sort of feel to it as well as a Western.
I think so. There's a very interesting Vanity Fair piece where both Campion and Cumberbatch talk about, you know, the acting process and how they approach this character. You're not a Cumberbitch, I hear, which is apparently the term for, but what he says is very, he's not been allowed to play this type of role. His role is definitely ambiguous and not. I'm supposing it's not a very lovable, mocking, cruel type of character. So I think it's going to be really something different for that we haven't seen from him before.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm definitely. It's definitely one of the highlights that I'm looking forward to in the main competition. I think good things could come from it. But I'm also, again, the slightly worrying thing as well is when somebody doesn't make films for years and years, you do sort of worry that not so much that they might have lost it, but that there's too much riding on too small a sample size, you know. I watched Deep Impact, Mimi Leder's film, asteroid hitting the Earth film, and she didn't make any movies for years after that film. It was a bit of a flop, I think, at the time as well. But that's another of the problems with the situation is that that women get far less of a chance to make movies. So when they do make one that doesn't necessarily succeed, it has a disproportionately negative effect on their careers.
Right. They just don't get the opportunity to master their craft more and more and to
Yeah,
make
yeah.
mistakes and to come back again.
Exactly. Or to do follies, you know, to do something which is really talented and interesting and out there, like New York, New York, for instance, to continue the Scorsese parallel. And then, but I think Campion, I'm pretty confident that this is going to be an interesting film. I'm looking forward to it.
Another Netflix movie, because this Power of the Dog is Netflix, is Sorrentino, who's back with his most personal film yet, which is just judging by the trailer and what I've read about his own story of a terrible tragedy that happened to him in his childhood, where he was saved by actually going to see soccer game or a football game with Maradona and how then cinema saved him. It's a very, very personal film starring his muse, Tony Servillo. What do you think? I don't think he feels like he's used his personal story very much until now.
No, absolutely not. I think there were sort of two main voices in Italian cinema at the moment. Italian cinema of this sort of auteur style, you know, because popular cinema is totally different. But Sorrentino is on one side and Matteo Garrone is on the other. And Garrone is more of sort of the realist, if it may be magical realist at times. And Sorrentino is much more the flamboyant sort of Fellini-esque kind of over the top, sort of very, very showy, very, very stylistic. Sorrentino in the past, I found ultimately far too, the style has began to grate after a while. You know, I was sort of there with him for Il Divo, which I think was his sort of international. I mean, he did Conseguenze dell'amore before Il Divo, but it was still like his arrival on the international stage. And then when he did La Grande Bellezza, The Great Beauty, and he did the one with Michael Caine, Youth. And yeah, I just find that there's a law of diminishing returns where everything that's happening in the film seems to be happening to give you a really good shot. You know, it's not happening because these things are actually happening. It's happening because these things look amazing and they go well with this piece of music. And in The Great Beauty, that works to some degree because it's about an aesthete, so you're sort of seeing it from his perspective. But when you get to his film about Silvio Berlusconi, which I think got a very limited release internationally, it was in Italy, it was like it's split into two parts, and it was a, like 4 or 5 hour film. And I think internationally it got like a shorter cut. It was just awful. I just really, really didn't like it at all, and it was kind of the over the top Sorrentino. So in a sense, I'm really pleased that he's going back to something which sounds personal, sounds a bit more heartfelt, and hopefully it will sort of give his you know, obviously amazingly talented visual sense something to do, something to say, because that's what's really lacked. He's someone who can make a wonderful looking film which ultimately doesn't really have anything to say. Now, this, as I say, I hope this breaks that trend.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. Sorrentino's talked openly about what happened to him in several articles recently, so I'll mention it here. He says when he was 17 years old, he went to a football game to see Maradona, and while he was there, his parents died tragically in a gas leak, I believe. And he delves right into this in this new movie, and also how cinema changed and saved him, so it's going to be very personal. John, would you say that Sorrentino is more criticized, more scrutinized back home in Italy than internationally?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I mean, there is definitely a sense that anybody who has international success from Italy, there's an ambivalence towards them. There's a sort of like, hooray for us! Look at Team Italy, you know, Forza Italia, and there's also a sense of you're selling a version of Italy which is very digestible to the outside world. So the things that he shows about Italy, you know, the vulgarity, the tastelessness of La Grande Bellezza, you know, it's an opera about tastelessness at the highest levels. That fits stereotypes, you know. Yeah, I think he confirms, you know, Il Divo is all about political corruption in Italy and has a plot which is as complicated as the actual real events that it's based on. But it also really does sort of slam home that idea of Italian politics just being, you know, baroquely corrupt. And La Grande Bellezza does have this, you know, huge critique of this sort of tastelessness and vulgarity in the midst of all this beauty, in the midst of all this. And again, it's sort of, yeah, those are all sorts. There are a heck of a lot of stereotypes sort of in there to unpack. So yeah, I think I'm a little bit because I've got a foot in both camps. I've lived in Italy for 20 odd years, and I'm obviously not Italian. I find when Italians are saying Sorrentino's terrible, that's an exaggeration. And when English people or people from outside of Italy are saying Sorrentino's a new Fellini, I say, no, he definitely is not that, you know.
It's going to be so interesting to hear what you think about this movie when we get back. I mean, it looms large in Sweden as well with, you know, Bergman, who isn't compared to the Fellini, the Bergman. It's like it's that getting out of a country means that you have to deal with that ghost.
Yeah, is it Harold Bloom and the anxiety of influence, you know, those the fathers you have to kill, the you know, the people who loom over you. And absolutely, I think Bergman in Sweden is comparable to Fellini and all of the, you know, Visconti and all of De Sica, that whole generation of filmmakers, really. And at least in Sweden, it's kind of one guy. In Italy, there's this big generation. He's
that
huge,
one guy
isn't he?
Looms large.
He's like a factory. He's like a factory of genius. I mean, Bergman's so amazing. Even Tarkovsky sort of goes to Sweden and makes a Bergman movie. You know, he can't make a Tarkovsky movie. He has to make a Bergman movie, you know.
There's going to be a lot of Bergman now with the remake of Scenes from a Marriage, which is actually going to be premiering in Venice.
Which I've only very recently actually watched. It's like during the lockdown, I watched the original. And I don't know if you need to do that again. I mean, it's so good. It's so, I don't see what you could bring except maybe to lead people back to the original. Yeah.
It's going to be really interesting to see.
Didn't Marriage Story do it as well? I mean, Marriage Story is Scenes from a Marriage.
Oh, the influence of Scenes from a Marriage is huge, of course. Marriage Story, Woody Allen. I mean, the director of the remake of Scenes from a Marriage himself, Haggai Levi's own work, The Affair and In Treatment on TV. So yeah, big shoes to film. But moving on to someone who has not so much taken on the father as he has the mother, Almodovar will be in Venice with his new film, Madres Paralelas, starring Penelope Cruz once again. It seems to be about two pregnant women who meet giving birth in a hospital and then their parallel motherhood stories. But now, Almodovar is a director whose films I very consistently have liked, and quite personally, you know, my mother was from Spain and ended up in the States, and long story, but even his later films, Dolor and Gloria, were really meaningful to me in how he's looked into that relationship between mothers and daughters and sons. So what is your relationship to Almodovar's career?
He hasn't really flagged Almodovar, has he? He hasn't, you know, he hasn't had that, the dip that you sort of would expect in such a long career. I mean, maybe he did that one film that I didn't see about an airport, which I think was universally considered one of his weakest films.
He's been very consistent. But I think you have to like Almodovar to think he's consistently interesting, or you just don't think he's ever been interesting. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I mean, I have watched him since he did those really sort of punkish films in the 80s as well. And that sort of streak of subversiveness sort of continues to this day, and you can see it in his more recent work as well. The Skin I Live In, I remember, I thought was a particular sort of highlight in terms of an interest, really interesting sort of movement into genre. I'm looking forward to this. I wouldn't say I'm his biggest fan. I think you're absolutely right. I think he is definitely a flavor. It's like a restaurant that you know what you're gonna get, and you always eat well, but if you don't like, you know, if you don't like paella, don't exactly. Go there, you know, that's what it is.
It's like Wes Anderson. I mean, I'm overjoyed that his trailer looks a lot like the other ones too, because I just think those visuals and that sensibility and the narrator and how it is just, it works for me. But if you really have not liked the things they've done before, then each one you have to come to again, sort of.
Yeah, exactly. And there's, I mean, I think with Wes Anderson, there's always a thing that if there's some, he's a director who needs a very strong presence pushing against him. I think it's kind of true of all of many directors, is they work best when there's somebody else who's very creative, sort of pushing again, maybe in another direction. And he had that in Grand Budapest Hotel with Ralph Fiennes. He has it in Royal Tenenbaums with Gene Hackman, Bottle Rocket with James Caan, Bill Murray in Rushmore. Has this, you know, really, and I think when he doesn't have it, like Darjeeling Limited or Life Aquatic, the films just become really indulgent. I think French Dispatch I enjoyed a lot, but the
structure,
yeah, I saw it. Cannes, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, if you like that restaurant, there's plenty to eat. It's a buffet, you know. It's all laid out for you.
Not so much into buffets during the pandemic, but I know.
No, finger food is not that. It's yeah, that's one of the things you've got to be careful when you go to Venice. Of course, everyone has spritz, and with your spritz there's always a little dish of crisps, and having crisps from a shared bowl is not a great idea during a pandemic.
So I want to talk a little bit about someone who's not in competition, but 83-year-old Ridley Scott coming out with two huge movies. One of them's going to be in Venice, The Last Duel, which is written by Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, who are also starring in it. He also later this year has House of Gucci, which I don't think anyone has missed that trailer, with Lady Gaga, about the murder in the Gucci family. That's two pretty big movies for Ridley Scott, 83 years old.
He's one of my favorites. Sorry, I just wanted to check, because I think there's also another writer as well as Affleck, and I think Nicole
Holofcener. Right.
Yeah.
Nicole Holofcener, who contributed. She's done the female parts of it somehow.
Which is an interesting choice as well, especially because Scott, one of his most successful films, and this goes back to what I was saying about Wes Anderson, is probably Thelma and Louise, in the, you know, right. I think post Alien and Blade Runner, it's probably his most successful movie. And it's one that's pushing, that he found himself with two Susans, especially with Susan Sarandon, with a major creative actress pushing against him and saying, and questioning him and forcing him. And he, I just read Ian Austin's book about Ridley Scott, who's just the retrospective, it's called. And he absolutely loved making Thelma and Louise, because he felt he was having a real creative collaboration with the actresses. I really like him. He's probably one of my earliest sort of directors. You know, I mean, I'll tell people in interviews, podcasts and things like that, I'll tell people that my first director that I really fell in love with was Orson Welles or was Stanley Kubrick. But really, probably Ridley Scott. Yeah, don't tell anyone. Because, you know, as a kid, it's got everything. It looks like a directed film. You know, all his films were very visually sort of unmistakable and beautiful and full of beautiful shots and full of interesting layered textured things, you know. And Alien and Blade Runner were two of the best science fiction films I'd ever seen. His later career has, you know, especially more recently, you know, has been incredibly successful financially. I mean, Martian was huge success. But has been a lot more sort of patchy, and he's consistently, his quality, I would always see a film of his at the cinema. You know, like Steven Spielberg, I would never think, wow, I can wait and see this on TV. So I'm really pleased to go and see The Last Duel. I'm really pleased that he's back to a historical topic, because I think he works well in this. I think Kingdom of Heaven, Gladiator, The Duelists. And one of my favorite Ridley Scott films is 1492, which I think is stunning. So I'm really pleased to see him back there. The reason that he's got these two films coming out in close conjunction is purely because of the pandemic, though. It's Last Duel was supposed to come out this time last year and was delayed a year. So he's made the other House of Gucci in the meantime, but Yeah. No, I'm looking forward to it. And it's good to see Damon and Affleck sort of return to writing.
Back
because
together
they're,
writing, yeah.
Yeah, because, you know.
It hasn't been since...
Goodwill Hunting,
Good
I think.
Hunting, yeah. I mean, that's been a long time they've done something together. It's going to be interesting to see if they still have it.
Well, yeah, and you could, you know, there's an argument for saying that was that they are much better screenwriters than they necessarily are actors.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's a bit cruel. But I mean, I don't mean to put them down as actors. I just mean that's a really good screenplay. That's a really well written piece of work. And Matt Damon getting sort of dunked on every 5 minutes for something he comes out with. You know, in an interview or something, which I always think is slightly unfair. I think Matt Damon always gets hit by the sort of Team America image of him as this sort of overly woke liberal who doesn't quite. He gets kicked by the left for not being woke enough, and he gets kicked by the right for being woke in the first place. So it's a little bit of a I think he's treated a bit unfairly. Poor Matt Damon.
Poor Matt Damon. Someone had some kind of analysis that every time Affleck was down, then everyone was kicking on the other one. And then when he was down, everyone was kicking on that one. And then they sort of meet up in the middle and make a movie.
Yeah, they go on Jimmy Kimmel in the middle.
Right. Then there's a bunch of other ones that, of course, people are talking about that I want to just ask you about. What are you expecting from Pablo Lorraine Spencer about Diana?
It looks like it. To me, it looks like in structure and format would be very similar to Jackie. So the film he made with Natalie Portman about Jackie Kennedy, and after Jackie Onassis, obviously. I think it's sort of like a week in the life of, or it's a few days in the life of Princess Diana at the point of crisis.
When she decided to divorce Charles, I think the weekend of that decision or something like
yeah
that.
Exactly. So I get the feeling that it'll be a slightly claustrophobic drama centered around a woman, you know, surrounded by hostility and, you know, making sort of trying to make a play for her own freedom and identity. Kristen Stewart, I'm really interested to see her actually play a real person, which she's done before, of course, with Seberg. And she did with T.J. Leroy as well, I think, the film about the sort of literary scandal of a writer who wasn't, you know, disguised themselves and all the rest of it. I mean, I think she can be a really wonderful actress. I think she can really sort of pull thing, you know, well, actress might not be the right word, movie star. She's really good at doing that. I'm not entirely sure she's really good at actually being other people. I mean, I didn't stop seeing Kristen Stewart in Seberg. There was no point at which I went,
right.
Oh, I can't, you know, in the sort
You're
of.
Always thinking.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, really her best performances are actually something like Personal Shopper, in which she's playing someone who could easily be Kristen Stewart, or, you know, who doesn't need to be anybody particularly different from who she is. Pablo Lorraine, though, is very interesting. He's made a TV series in the meantime as well, Lisa's Story, which I haven't had the opportunity
Stephen
to see.
King, right?
Yeah. That's right, yeah, an adaptation. So he's definitely busy. He's definitely broken through. I'll be interested. I think he's a great director.
I mean, I know it was very divisive. I thought Natalie Portman, who people thought her performance was weird, I thought it was amazing. I thought it was such an interesting delve into media and how you sort of manipulate, you know, the headlines and what fame means and what really truth means, whose truth is being put out there. I thought the music was just...
It was like Mika Levy, wasn't
Mika
it?
Mika Levy. I thought it was amazing. The only thing I think is it seems a bit like it's kind of the same thing. I mean, it's definitely two women who are in the absolute spotlight in a negative sense of media during their lives, who were just trashed and went through horrible tragedies and traumas and but it's going to be interesting, I'm sure. I mean, he's such a great director that it has to be something that makes it, you know, that interests him in these two women in different ways as well. But that's what I'm sort of wrapping my head around, is how what is his thesis, if you can use that word.
No, I actually, that's really interesting you use the word, because I was just thinking exactly that there's a PhD thesis already to be written, isn't there?
Yes.
Pablo Larraín and you know, female, the centers of female power or something. You can imagine a DVD box set coming out soon. You know, you're waiting for there's never two without three. You're waiting for the final film in the trilogy, unless it's Neruda, unless, you know, I mean, this will be his third biopic or film, not really biopic, but film about a biographical subject, I guess. Because I actually really rated Neruda, which came out before Jackie, and I thought was a really interesting delve into the life of the famous poet, you know.
He definitely makes biopics interesting. And then we have one of three Oscar Isaac projects which are coming. He's in Dune, he's in Marriage, Scenes from a Marriage, which we just talked about, and The Card Counter, which is the taxi driver legend Paul Schrader's movie, who I really loved First Reformed. I thought that was really good that he did a couple of years ago, who's been very criticized for how he is on social media and what he says and how he talks about women. He's back in Venice with this film that's described, the plot is described as, William Tell is a gambler and former serviceman who sets out to reform a young man seeking revenge on a mutual enemy from their past. So what do you think of Schrader, his legacy, and his arrival with this new movie?
Yeah, I mean, Schrader is definitely one of those sort of leftovers from the 70s generation. And I think if you read the original Taxi Driver script, there's a lot of sexism in the script, which isn't just, you know, the old thing of, you know, is it sexist or is it about sexism? But the description I remember of Sybil Shepherd's character in the sort of stage direction, you know, rather than the dialogue, is fairly horrible. So yeah, he's definitely sort of got form. Well, I mean, he's a product, like everybody, he's a product of the situation that he was growing up in. And the 70s were an incredibly different time for the way men thought they ought to think about women.
That hasn't really changed, because if you read some of the, I haven't read it all, but some of the Facebook things that I've seen, that streak has continued, how he sort of describes waitresses, sort of everyday life of how he sees women shines through still.
Sure. I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, I'm not defending him or making any apology for him, but I'm just also sort of like, you know, no shit, Sherlock, you know, an old geezer who grew up in the 60s and 70s has got fairly reprehensible sort of knee-jerk views about women. I mean, in terms of his work, Schrader has... I always think of him as slightly, you know how you sometimes get confused between two directors. The one I most easily confuse Paul Schrader with is Abel Ferrara. I always have this flip that I always think they all kind of both work in genre. They're both very New York sensibilities. They both probably have already done their best work quite a few years ago. But in contrast to Abel Ferrara, I think Paul Schrader's more recent films, from Dog Eat Dog, The First Reformed, and hopefully this one, have actually been much, much better. And not only better, not only good as in, oh, it's nice to see the guy who wrote Raging Bull, you know, making a good movie, but actually, you know, as good as anything he's done. You know, I think First Reformed definitely has the possibility of being the best film he directed, you know, which is saying something, given that he, you know, directed Mishima and a whole bunch of pretty good movies, Cat People, the remake and whatnot. But yeah, I know. I mean, just going back to that toxic masculinity sort of thing. I mean, he's kind of the poet laureate of toxic masculinity, isn't he? So, I mean, that's kind of...
And that was what was interesting with First Reformed, because there he was delving, sort of like we were talking about with Almodovar and Sorrentino, that he was delving into a bunch of religious quandaries that he's had since his youth, since he grew up. in a very religious household and what that sort of meant to him when he started afterward. And it just, it was a very, it felt very personal in its themes, maybe not in its plot, but and you could feel that, and that he really was directing from that place.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's definitely. And I think he's, you know, I mean, there's a little bit of the Old Testament prophet about him. He has always looked a little bit nihilistically and certainly pessimistically at the world. And the times seem to fit that point of view. You know, they seem to be, you know, when I remember listening to him during the press conference, and he was basically saying, look, the human race had a good run, but I'd be very surprised if we'll still be around, you know, in another 100 years. And he seriously meant it. He was absolutely convinced, you know.
Moving along here towards the end, one of the things this year got a little bit of flack for was that there were fewer female filmmakers compared to, I think there was only 5 in competition. There was 8 last year, but and we haven't mentioned all that many are Campion. But I am looking forward to Maggie Gyllenhaal's The Lost Daughter. It's written and directed by Maggie Gyllenhaal. I believe it's her first film directorial debut. I think she's done some TV. It's based on the novel by the same name, by Elena Ferrante, and it stars a whole amazing crew: Olivia Colman, Jesse Buckley, Dakota Johnson, Peter Sarsgaard. So do you know any more about this?
No, I don't, and I don't know much, but I think it's always good to sort of welcome new voice as well, you know, the more the merrier, frankly, at this stage. And I also would say this, that this argument against quotas, for instance, you know, the Berlinale have got a sort of 50% quota system now in place. I think it always rings very, very hollow in Venice, because there seems to be no problem having a really large proportion of Italian films in competition when Italian films don't, especially in Venice. I mean, really, the best, if you have a really good Italian film, it goes to Cannes. Maybe Berlin. It doesn't go to Venice. I mean, Venice is where you know, there can be the occasionally good one, but you get a heck of a lot of mediocre Italian films. So there seems to be an unofficial quota for Italian films in the competition. So why you can't just have why you can't have more women there? It does, to me, that argument doesn't hold
it's
water.
Hollow.
Yeah, absolutely. As for
It's why they see this one, because it is an Elena Ferrante based on her book. It is sort of Italian. They're sort of putting it into that quota there. I guess it must be filmed in Italy too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think to some degree it's easier for them. I mean, festivals do have, there is a certain sort of, you know, sausage factory about festivals where a lot of considerations have nothing to do with high art or quality of the film or anything. And so the fact that The Lost Daughter will bring a red carpet moment for Jesse Buckley, Dakota Johnson, Olivia Colman, you know, Oscar winner, Alba Rohrwacher, who is in every single film ever made, will also be there. And Maggie Gyllenhaal herself. You know, I think that also has a certain sort of impact on their decision of whether to put a film in competition. So I think there's an element, if Maggie Gyllenhaal was the first time female director who hadn't appeared in a bunch of movies, she might not have found herself in competition as well. And again, that's nothing. I'm not in any way suggesting that she doesn't deserve to, or there's no merit in it. I'm just saying that these calculations, so that will have benefited her to get her that place. They just should have a lot more. That's all. I'm, you know, it's no excuse. Yeah, this is one that will be really interesting. I mean, it's interesting to compare this with, say, Jane Campion as well. That you're getting somebody who is relatively fresh to directing. And I was just going to say, and I would watch Olivia Colman read the phone book. She's such an amazing actress that she's also one of these actresses who's having a really good run of script reading, that she's obviously getting a lot of scripts because of her Oscar win, and because she's amazing, you know, amazing. Because she's really good. And she's getting, and she's picking them very, very well. I think, you know, every film she's in, I'm fascinated to see what she does.
She's just the best. I'd even share those pandemic crisps with her.
I don't think they sell them. I don't think they're branded as pandemic crisps.
when we do part two of this in Venice, we're going to be eating with our pandemic crisps. We'll sponsor the show. So I want to end up with Dune, which is the big one. But I was wondering if there's anything else. Is there something you wanted to highlight to me that I should see while there that I haven't, that we really didn't get into here before we get into Dune?
There are a lot of documentaries. Not necessarily in the competition, outside of the competition as well, which I think there's a documentary on Hallelujah, the Leonard Cohen song.
Leonard Cohen, yes.
Which if you're a Leonard Cohen fan, I would definitely recommend. There's also a film, Mona Lisa and the Blood Moon, by Anna Lily Amirpour, who made A Girl Walks Home at Night. She made a for me, a really poor film called The Bad Batch. I'm hoping that was a blip, and that would be interesting as well to see. Of the rest, I'm trying to think of the other. No, there's nothing. I think we've covered all the ones that I was thinking about as well. And I was really upset that Blonde didn't turn up, by Andrew Dominik. But I think the reason, there was a very specific reason behind that, which was Netflix didn't like it. They didn't like the cut.
I have also heard that they're fighting with Dominik. I mean, that he wants the final cut, and they're happy with, which is so weird from Netflix point of view, because if you get Andrew Dominik to make this incredible novel I'm not sure what you expect.
the novel is a deconstruction of this sort of sex symbol into the human reality and the lived experience of the woman who's, it's amazing. You know, it's a really good book, and it's really well written. It's really, really, I think it's one of Joyce Carol Oates' best books. Andrew Dominik is one of our best directors, uncompromising directors. So what did you expect?
I don't know. But let's talk about Dune. I guess Dune is the big get for Venice. It's the big blockbuster that most of the festivals wanted. I'm no huge Dune expert, but I've delved into the book and seen Lynch movie. I really like Villeneuve's previous work. So, but what are your expectations?
Well, I am the expert.
Oh, good. See, that's why I called.
No, Dune was the book that I can't even remember having never read. I read it when I was very young, and I was constantly reading it in combination with Lord of the Rings until I was 15, I think. So I repeatedly read, and I recently reread it as well. And so I'm a big fan of the book. And in terms of the movie, and I'm also a fan of the original David Lynch movie. I think it looks amazing. I think the style of and the design in that movie is unsurpassed. It really does manage to avoid the cliches of science fiction and do something very different.
It's kind of unfairly treated by history, I have to say.
Well, I mean, it kind of doesn't work as a film. I mean, the first half, it feels like a film, and then the second half feels like you've missed out an episode of a TV show, and you're watching the sort of like, and then Paul fell in love with Chaney, and then this happened, and then that happens. It's like, wait, what? What are we doing this now? We're fast forwarding. So Villeneuve has got away from that possible danger by splitting his film into two parts. One comment that he made recently really worried me. He was in an interview for Vanity Fair or somewhere like that he mentioned that he's currently writing the script for part two. And there's just a bit of me that thinks, if you're writing a two-part movie, wouldn't you write it like all? And then so that if there's anything that you discover while you're writing part two, you can go back to part one and fix it. I always find that really weird that you wouldn't forefront the writing just so you know where to go. So he hasn't written the script yet. He hasn't finished the script yet. And this is only part one of the movie. And so this could be a very Golden Compass moment where we get a big, splendid, really admirable beginning of a saga. And it doesn't do well enough at the box office to justify the second part. And I given the starriness of the cast and given the expenses of making a science fiction movie and given the performance of Blade Runner 2049, I'm going into this with an added trepidation of not only is the movie going to be good, but are we ever going to see the sort of full version of the movie, or are we just going to see the first part? Because the book doesn't have there is a dividing point, but it isn't a conclusion. There's no way you would think this will be a standalone story. So in that sense, there are a lot of question marks around this. Having said that, the trailer looks good. He's a brilliant visual. The cast looks phenomenal. He's brilliant visually. And Arrival was a great movie. I do worry because Denis Villeneuve reminds me a lot of Ridley Scott. But I think Ridley Scott is someone who worries a bit more about script and story than Denis Villeneuve does. And one of the problems I had with 2049 is that was a 90-minute film lounging in 2.5 hours of cinematography. And as beautiful as it was so boring. I mean, it was a beautiful, gorgeous, sounded wonderful, love, you know. And I think this sort of is a problem with science fiction generally. So there's all this idea of building universes and stuff. And it's like, yeah, that's all great, but you've actually got to have a story. You've actually got to have, you know, and keep hold of your story and make it interesting. I don't think 2049 did that, even though I totally admire that movie. I think I gave it 5 stars when I reviewed it for Cineview. I was knocked out and impressed by it, but at the same time, bored.
you're giving up all your secrets here.
Oh, only on this, exclusively.
Exactly. Well, I'm so looking forward to meeting up with you again to see what we actually thought.
Yeah.
I'm excited. There's a lot of directors and performers and things here that have meant something to me and that I've been new ones that haven't. So the lineup for me feels really good. So
I bet you a spritz that the film that we end up talking about most is something we've not mentioned.
We haven't seen. Exactly.
Yeah. It's not on our radar at all. That will be the film that we'll be going, oh, I can't believe that. It's a miracle of a movie.
Thank you, John. Tell everyone what your next episode is of Writers on Film and things like that.
Okay, so you can find me on Twitter at Dr. Jonty, DrJonty. And the next episode is coming out on Friday and is about Rob Young, who's written a brilliant book called The Magic Box, which is all about TV and film in 70s and 80s Great Britain. And it's a lot of it sort of folk horror. And it's just an amazing book. And it was great to have him on and talk to him. And you can find that on iTunes and Spotify and wherever you can get podcasts.
Everywhere, where you find this one as well. All right. Thank you so much. See you next week.
Thank you, Christina. Bye.
I'm Anne-Marie Kelly. Wild Precious Life is a podcast about dreaming big, digging in and connecting across distance, division, and loss. In each episode, I talk with prize-winning writers, musicians, and wanderers who remind all of us how we can make the most of the time we have. So meet me here. Let's walk and talk and dream and discover what it means to be wild, precious, and brave.